Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to Our Shelves, a podcast where writers from the legendary feminist publishing house Virago talk about their cultural worlds. We'll be diving into these writers' bookshelves, record collections, and recollections to discover what inspires them. I'm Lucy Scholes, and my guest today is Claire Coder. Claire Coder is a writer and musician. She reviews books for publications including The Guardian and the TLS, specialising in books from and about East Asia. Her essay Portraits, about her experiences growing up mixed race, also features in East Side Voices, essays celebrating East and Southeast Asian identity in Britain, edited by Helena Lee and published by Scepter. As a violinist, she has played with Jessie Ware, Pete Tong, the London Contemporary Orchestra, and on various film soundtracks, including The Two Popes and The Matrix Resurrections. Welcome to Our Shelves, Claire. It's such a lovely pleasure to have you here today. And what a fascinating bio you have, all these kind of different strings to your bow, if I'm going to use a sort of musical term. But I think maybe we'll get to talk a little bit more about music later in the show. But to begin with, I want to ask you a little bit about your debut novel, Woman Eating, which is published this month by Virago. It's out this week, so some of our listeners might have had a chance to pick it up already, but a lot of them won't have already. So could you tell us a little bit about this novel, please?
So Woman Eating is about Lydia, and she is a young mixed race vampire. I always pause at vampire because I feel like people get a certain kind of idea in their heads when I hear the word vampire, and I usually try to save it to the end of the description, but she is a vampire, and she is trying to kind of make her way as an artist in the contemporary art world in London. But most of the book is about food, really, and about her, I guess, exploring her cultural identity through food.
Let's go back to the vampire bit, because it is really fascinating. It's such a, I mean, vampires are such a kind of, there's such an interesting motif in literature, obviously, through the years, and this kind of new, your presentation of Lydia and her sort of vampiric qualities, and her, she has a sort of real push and pull relationship with her sort of natural tendencies towards her sort of bloodlust, let's put it that way. It's not the kind of classic, very gory vampire story in many ways. It's a story about hunger, but a story about being hungry for things that you both know and things that you don't know, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so it's definitely not a normal vampire book. And yeah, I kind of, the fact that she's a vampire was always kind of incidental, even though I knew from the beginning that she was going to be a vampire. It was always a kind of tool, I guess, to explore certain things about being human that I was interested in.
Mm. Have you always been quite interested in vampires as a sort of literary figures? Or is this a kind of, you know, is it something that's kind of sat in you for quite a while and you've been intrigued and thinking, how can I do something with this? Or like you say, did it come kind of late in the storytelling process and thinking, you know, this would be an interesting element to add to the text or a way of exploring certain human issues, but through a different prism?
I feel like I shouldn't say this, but I have never read a vampire book.
Really?
Including Dracula.
That's fascinating. Is that on purpose, or did you decide to steer clear of them once you knew you were going to write about a vampire because you didn't want that sort of to sink into...
I did that too, yeah, but I'd say it was never something that I was kind of drawn to. The books I read mostly are from East Asia. And I think there's like a kind of tradition in Japanese literature and also Korean literature, and actually in the literature of a lot of Asian countries, of kind of having a supernatural element or a supernatural kind of figure, be that like a ghost or obviously in Japanese literature you've got yokai, and it not kind of defining the genre of the book. And that's kind of how I approached writing this book. I didn't ever think, oh, I want to write a vampire book or a horror or anything like that. It was more, I guess I was kind of following in that tradition, the kind of more Asian tradition.
That's really fascinating. And that also brings us to kind of, I think, our first question here on the nightstand, because you're going to tell me about two books that are currently on your bedside table. The first one is a work of fiction, isn't it, called Where the Wild Ladies Are. Could you tell us a bit about this book? Who's it by? Why it intrigued you?
It's such a good book. So it's by Matsuda Aoko, who's a Japanese writer, and it's translated by Polly Barton. It's a collection of stories that kind of interlock. Each story is based on a kind of like traditional folktale from Japan, but they've all been retold through a feminist lens. So yeah, it's an amazing book. It's about ghosts and I guess monsters in a sense, but it's definitely not a horror. You can't really define it by those things. It's very much, it's about kind of being a woman in society, basically.
It sounds very much like exactly like what you were describing just now in terms of these books that take what perhaps kind of traditionally Western readers would think of as kind of tropes of horror, or we would like to kind of put these books into a particular genre, but actually what you're saying is that in a different kind of cultural context, these are very different ways of approaching these and very different ways of using monsters and ghosts and sort of, you know, whether they're monsters, ghosts or vampires, right? And so you're writing into this a similar tradition.
Yeah, exactly. In Japan you have, say, for instance, Mishima. This was like maybe a year before I wrote Woman Eating, I reviewed Life for Sale. It's about a man who basically decides to put an advert in the paper, kind of like selling his life, like saying like, you can use my life for whatever you want. Like, it doesn't matter if I die, I'm selling it. The whole novel is him kind of being bought by various people. One of the people that buys him is the son of a woman who is a vampire. So there's a vampire in this novel by Mishima. Again, it's like, it's not what defines it. It doesn't get pigeonholed as like supernatural even. It's just another novel by Mishima. And yeah, I really like that kind of lack of boundaries, the way that that means that you can just kind of dip into these things that in the West we would consider are like different genres.
Really fascinating, and a completely different way of sort of attuning our, someone like myself who's maybe not so used to reading these kind of novels, or to attune myself to a completely different way of reading them and kind of taking them in and what to what to get from them. I'm very intrigued by this Where the Wild Ladies Are now. I think I'm going to have to get a copy now you've sold it to me so much.
It's so amazing. Yeah, I like struggled to talk about it because it's so good.
That's like the best thing you can say about a novel. I struggle to even talk. It's too brilliant.
It's really amazing. And it didn't really get the amount of attention I feel like it deserves. And I think like a lot of the time there's like one big Japanese novel that is like a bestseller in the UK. And I think at the time it was Convenience Store Woman.
Okay. So
and it was like there wasn't like enough space for her to exist as well. But it's amazing. It's so good.
If listeners liked Convenience Store Woman, or even if they didn't, like, go out and get a copy of Where the Wild Ladies Are, and then you can see what else is out there. And the second book you're going to tell us about is something completely different, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's the Korean vegan cookbook.
Tell me about this. Are you someone who reads cookbooks in bed in that sort of food porn way that people love doing? I've never done it myself, but I know people love doing it. I think I wouldn't be able to sleep. I'd be too hungry. But
so the thing that I really like about this book is that it kind of came out of social media. The book is so different to her social media posts.
Is that how you first came across her, that you knew her via social media and then got the book afterward?
Yeah. While I was writing Woman Eating, a big part of the process was kind of like trying to understand what Lydia's experience of food might be. And if she's a vampire, she can't eat food, basically. Obviously, she eats blood. A lot of how she kind of engages with like food culture is through Instagram and YouTube, by watching like what I eat in a day videos, also watching videos by influencers who are kind of exploring their Asian identity through food. And the Korean vegan really interested me. And this was quite a long time ago. It was 2020. She'd been doing her videos for, I don't know how long it had been, but they had a different format to what they have now. Now she's usually in the video. But back then it was these beautiful videos of just dishes being cooked, kind of like bird's eye view. And then she'd narrate them, tell these stories about kind of her cultural heritage, her like relationship to her Korean heritage and her family, like stories about her mom coming to America from North Korea. And it's just, oh, it's so beautiful just watching like this dish come together and hearing about like, you know, stories about her dad and their relationship and stuff. It was, yeah, really, really lovely. And Lydia, as someone who can't explore her heritage through food, I feel like she gets a lot from watching those kinds of videos where people are exploring their heritage through food. But the Korean vegan was interesting in particular because she's vegan. And there's a video that is in the book, actually, where she talks about the first time she became vegan and how she was worried that she wouldn't be seen as Korean because she was cutting out this huge part of Korean cuisine.
Yeah.
That I found really interesting because obviously with Lydia, she doesn't have access to any food.
It's a really fascinating idea, isn't it, that how do you lay claim to a certain aspect of your identity if part of that identity is kind of out of bounds to you, right? And you can't enjoy and partake in it. It's a fascinating way of thinking about it.
And it's like, does that mean that she's less Japanese, less Malaysian, less English? Those are the kinds of questions that I think she worries about. But yeah, then the Korean vegan Joanne Molinaro released this cookbook, and it's just a really beautiful kind of collection of home-cooked meals.
And does she sort of tell the stories about her heritage and sort of culture through in the cookbook as much as on the videos?
Not as much.
Okay.
Not as much. Yeah, I kind of see it as like a companion to her
right.
Instagram or TikTok.
But that in itself is so interesting, right? Because in the past, I suppose traditionally cookbooks themselves would have been the sort of the final result of, you know, that would be the thing that you would put together. But the idea that it can be a sort of companion piece to something that lives more perhaps online. And like you say, you were much more attracted initially, at least, to the sort of story she told around the cuisine and around her sort of the cultural kind of context of it, that it doesn't quite translate into the book into the same way. You sort of have to have that visual and kind of, you know, the more visceral element on the in the videos.
I think her voice makes such a big difference as well.
Okay.
Just actually having her speaking to you while she's cooking, that feels like, it's just like kind of, I don't think she's old enough to be my mom. It feels the same as, you know, going home and like my mom cooking food from her childhood and her telling me a story about like, I don't know, her brother or something from from her past.
Well, there is, and you do in the novel go into the sort of almost ASMR kind of elements of food, and you know, even though Lydia can't taste it, she can. She's very attuned, I think, to the way that things kind of look and smell and sound, because maybe that, I suppose, that's the way that she has to experience it, in, you know, differently to other people. But I guess so much, I'm kind of fascinated by those video, those cooking videos that really take that to the furthest degree, and all the chop, the sounds of chopping, and the sort of, and the sizzle of things going into the pan. And it's true that it kind of, you know, I guess because we're so trained to think, you know, you hear that sort of happening in the kitchen and you start salivating and you know you want to eat something. But it's really fascinating what sort of sound can do without even the taste element, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love, like, kitchens. I just love being in kitchens, and the sounds of people cooking, and I find it really comforting. And I like cooking myself as well.
So next up, Claire, you're going to tell me about a recent song that's been on your mind.
Yeah, that's Turn Away by Laura Moody, who is a singer, songwriter and cellist. She's amazing.
I watched a video of this when you told me this is what you were going to talk about, but I was so fascinated in the way that she uses her cello as a sort of instrument. She kind of taps on it in different ways as well as playing it. It wasn't what I was expecting from a sort of traditional song. Yeah. For listeners who don't know this particular song, can you maybe explain it in slightly more eloquent terms than me?
Try. It's Laura, basically, she uses her cello kind of like a percussion instrument.
Right.
But it's not just that either. There's, because that sounds really violent, but it's very tender. At the same time, she uses her voice in a really unusual way too. And it's almost like she's using her body as an instrument,
right,
as well. She does a lot of really interesting things with her voice. Like, there's a part where she's kind of like, it's almost like a scream, but very quiet. It's like a whispered scream.
Mm.
The thing I like about Laura's music is it's very, I'd say it's quite wild and quite kind of animal.
Mm.
And yet her voice is also really feminine. It's tender and it can be really delicate as well. But at the same time, it can be really kind of dark and almost unstable.
I found there were certain moments in it that were really sort of raw. That would be the way I would describe it, that they just sort of, she'd do one thing with her voice that I was sort of expecting, and then a sound that I really couldn't, A, wasn't expecting to hear, but B, couldn't quite work out where it had come from in her body even, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was like nothing I'd heard. I was really taken aback by it. And very surprised. Is this something that a lot of musicians are doing, or does this really kind of mark her out as somebody doing something different and of their own?
I would say, I mean, the cello is interesting as an instrument just because the range of the cello is so close to the voice.
Okay.
But with Laura, there's something very unique to her music, I think. And there's just something very, it sounds really tacky, but like real about it. Like it feels like she's really open when she's playing her music, I think.
And can I take this opportunity to ask you a little bit about your own music? Because you've clearly, as I sort of mentioned earlier, you've got these two quite different strands to your career, you know, your writing on the one hand and then your music on the other. And how do they sort of, you know, how do you strike the balance between the two? How much of your life is spent sort of devoted to your music? How much to your writing? Like, tell me a little bit about that.
Someone asked me this really recently, actually, about time split between writing and music, and I find it really hard to answer. I think partly because with music, I kind of trained for my whole life.
Okay.
Feels like there's so much time that's been put into it. I don't know. I find it really hard to compare.
Is it perhaps because music, like you say, you've trained so much, and is it more like a steady bedrock in your life that's sort of always been there for such a long time? Probably the appreciation, I presume you started playing when you were relatively young, if you've, you know, you're trained to the kind of capabilities that you've got now. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I started piano when I was 4 and then violin when I was 11.
So that's like your whole life has been, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I've been playing for my whole life, and then that stopped in the pandemic, which was really weird. And actually, that was kind of the context from which Woman Eating was written.
Oh, really? Because you needed something to do, or had you had the idea for the novel for quite a while and was it just finding time to do it?
I mean, I've been writing for a long time for papers and I've always been drawn to fiction writing as well. But the pandemic, the first year was quite strange because I think after maybe a month or so, or maybe like a few weeks, I realised that it was like the longest I'd been not playing music with other people. And that was just like a month.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite, it definitely felt like it wasn't just like losing a job. It was more like, it's kind of like music's not exactly like a religion, but like kind of like a god. And it's like it feels that big to lose it.
Wow.
Yeah. So over the pandemic, I was doing a little bit here and there from home, but it was very different. Like a lot of musicians I know couldn't even like touch their instruments.
Really?
Yeah, which is really sad. Yeah, it was a really weird time being a musician.
I don't think I'd ever thought about the sort of emotional, you know, the obvious element of not being able to earn a living and probably clearly missing out. And like you say, the kind of strangeness of suddenly not being able to perform with people. But I hadn't considered the sort of emotional intensity or reaction that one might have, the sort of not being able to pick up an instrument or feeling, I suppose, a sort of bereavement almost, right? That you'd lost this great part of your life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, music is a form of communication. So it's kind of like losing your voice or something. But yeah, it was a very strange time to exist as a musician. And I felt like only musicians really understood.
I'm so fascinated then to know whether writing the novel, a different form of creativity, but kind of creativity nonetheless. And did that fill a sort of gap in you? Was it how was the experience? How did it compare those sort of two different, that I suppose is what I want to know. How did the experience of sort of playing this music and being in communication with people that way, and then this very silent kind of quite lonely process, right, of writing the novel until it's out in the world?
It definitely didn't fill the gap. One thing is with music is because I freelance, it means I'm doing quite a few like different projects. Say, for instance, if I've been doing sessions for like 3 days and it's like a film score or something, at the end of those 3 days, you're done and it's like you leave and then that project kind of gets put out there in the world and it exists. It's there. Or if it's a gig, you turn up, you play and it's like it exists. It's kind of, it's intangible, but it feels very tangible.
And there's a sort of sense of completion under it, under each thing, right? Like that it's done it, you've finished, and it's there, right? Exit. And writing is not like that. Or writing a novel is not like that, I imagine.
But I think I was kind of craving, I felt like I hadn't done anything over the pandemic because I hadn't been doing these things. And it's not true, I hadn't.
Even though you'd written a novel, right? That's most people sat down in the first week of the pandemic and said, oh, I'll write a novel, and then just sat on their sofa and ate crisps.
This is okay. Before the novel. But yeah, the novel in a way filled that gap in a sense. It was filled the urge I have to kind of be putting things out there, to be creating things, I guess, basically. Over the pandemic, I did a lot of drawing, but it was very quiet. And yeah, I don't know, nothing really fills the gap of music.
And I presume, are you back playing now? Are you back doing?
Yeah.
And what was that like the first time you went back and played with other people after that break?
So actually, the Matrix Resurrection soundtrack was one project that we did record over the pandemic.
Okay.
And the first session was right before the pandemic. I'd say a few weeks before things like, you know, got mad. And then the second one was, it must have been like a year later, and it was meant to be much earlier.
Wow.
But that was my first one back. We did like multiple COVID tests and had to be distanced in the studio as well, which was quite strange. But yeah, it was so nice to be back. Really, really nice.
Was it like a sort of was it a very intense emotional experience as much as just a kind of fun seeing people and enjoying doing what you're doing? There must have been such a sense of release, I suppose, after being stuck by oneself.
I'd say so, definitely. I mean, I felt that. I don't know whether I'm just a really emotional person, but But yeah, it was definitely just, I mean, I love being in that environment. Yeah. There's nothing quite like it. But also seeing friends again.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it was like two things at once, music yeah. and friends coming back. And yeah, it was really lovely. But the music itself for that film was so hard. it was amazing music, but just like, it was tricky. So there was a lot of kind of like stress.
Oh my God, that must be the kind of a hot, you've got all the intense emotion of coming back, seeing people doing it again, but also a really hard yeah. work to do at the same time. Sounds incredibly stressful and anxiety making on different levels. That's great. Arshelle's be back in just a moment.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Our Shelves. I'm Lucy Scholes, and I'm talking to Claire Coder about the intense emotion that she felt when she was first back in a room with a full orchestra after having to take a break during the pandemic. Next up, Claire, I'm going to ask you to tell me about a book that has made you think about feminism in a new way.
The name of the book is Barbara Hepworth, Writings and Conversations, and it's edited by Sophie Bowness, who I think is her granddaughter. And it's basically a book of, it's what it says it is. It's just full of her writings and things that she said and interviews with her. And yeah, it's a really, I love this book. I just dip in and out of it.
When did you first come across it?
Fairly recently, actually, but Barbara Hepworth and what her art has been in my life since I was about four.
Okay.
When my parents took me to, I think it was the Sculpture Park in St. Ives, but I don't remember because I was four. And what I do remember is my dad, who's an artist, basically showing me one of her artworks. So we were kind of standing next to one of her artworks. And it was before I really had a concept of what an artwork even was. To me, it was, you know, we could have been standing next to something. It was the same as standing next to a tree or something, you know. It was just this stone with a hole and the garden through it. And but I've got photos that I don't know whether it's my mum who took them or my dad, but it's me peeping through the hole Barbara Hepworth sculpture. And yeah, my dad taught me kind of about like optical illusions for the first time, and how she kind of played with like flatness and how she framed the landscape and stuff. It was quite a big thing for a four-year-old to learn.
It sounds quite intense.
And I remember touching the stone And, you know, my dad was touching the stone as well. And it was just this really lovely moment. And my dad, at that time, he was quite influenced by her work. So he was doing a lot of carving. Who's making a lot of kind of pairs of sculptures, which is what Hepworth is known for, her kind of mother and child pieces. Mm. It was never even, I mean, I knew she was a woman, but, you know, my dad never made a point of that. It was just, this is an artist. I really love her. And she's influenced my work. And only later did I really kind of get to, sounds weird, but get to know her and kind of learn about her life and her work and what it meant for her to be a woman doing what she was doing, in particular working with the materials that she was working with, so stone and metal, mm-hmm. bronze in particular, they were considered very masculine. She explored motherhood through stone, and through wood carving, and in this book, actually, she talks about how all of her sculpture is about love. She's interesting because I think, obviously, Georgia O'Keeffe is really well known for being kind of very defiant against being called a woman artist. Mm. And I think woman artist is like a really shitty phrase. Obviously, it's ghettoizing. It's like, it's just, and like, Georgia O'Keeffe was right. Like, it led to her work being kind of flattened, perceived in a way that was completely flat. Barbara Hepworth is interesting because she talks a lot in this book about why femininity is important and why kind of like softness is important. She saw herself as a woman as kind of bringing that to the material that had been, I guess, dominated by men, but also seen as something really masculine. So at the same time as she was working during the war, Henry Moore was also making sculptures with holes piercing through them. And they were compared all the time, obviously. But Henry Moore's sculptures were very much about like trauma and violence during the war. Whereas Barbara Hepworth, she saw the kind of like piercing of her sculptures as like creating a space, like a refuge. Mm. And they were supposed to be kind of like healing and comforting. And she says something really beautiful. She says, "My sculpture has often seemed to me like offering a prayer at moments of great unhappiness." And the unhappiness she's talking about in this case is after the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And I think after Silent Spring was written as well, maybe, because she talks about pollution a little bit. And then she says, "In another age, I would simply have carved cathedrals," which I think is so beautiful.
Wow.
Her work, she really... she saw herself very much as a mother.
Mm.
But she kind of very much controlled the narrative. So she wasn't kind of reduced in the way a lot of artists are.
How did she do that? Because she was so sort of outspoken is maybe too strong a word, but because she was so firm in what in sort of putting out there what certain things meant to her and why it was important that she worked with these materials and what that, you know, the context of that was?
I think she did kind of talk a lot about her work.
Okay.
And it's kind of sad to think that like she needed to do that to be treated seriously, to be taken seriously, whereas someone like Henry Moore didn't really need to.
Yeah, the sort of wasted time that she had to spend doing that rather than doing the work, I suppose, the kind of the extra effort you have to make in order to have it taken seriously in the same way.
She says here that she's constantly plagued by this little woman attitude. that there's a deep prejudice against women in art. But she says after that that there's a misconception that sculpture kind of involves, like she says, muscular brute bashing. That it like involves violence, basically, and like physical strength.
Mm.
It was very small physically. And then she says that the sculpture, stone in particular, is not something to be hacked at. So it never surrenders to force. One must seek out the latent form within the stone, and then it need only be touched with the chisel and the form will appear. And I think that's just, yeah.
That's a sort of very beautiful way of thinking about the process of making so much art, right? The sort of the gentle touch, that idea of the only need to touch with the chisel and then, wow. You're making me want to read the book. I know a little bit about Hepworth, but I haven't read this particular collection, and it sounds like it's very important and brilliant. Thank you very much. And last up today then, Claire, I'm going to ask you to tell me about a woman or a person of an unrepresented gender whom you admire. And I think you're sticking with another artist for this, aren't you?
Suzanne Valadon, a painter from Paris. She was born in 1865 to a working class mother, and she's a really fascinating woman. So she, as a child, she was known as an opera rat, which at the time basically meant poor kids who hung around outside the opera houses. And she got into trouble. And she
came to be an opera rat. Like, that sounds like such a cool childhood.
Yeah, she was quite wild, I think, and really struggled with education. She was always kind of seen on the roofs, just running around pretending to be an animal. And she did something that I find really fascinating about her is when she was a child, she used to go to strangers' funerals and pretend that she was a mourner. Which I find really fascinating and really strange. So she kind of, I think that was kind of, it's kind of telling of how the rest of her life went, because she became an artist's model. So she's in a lot of paintings. She became a model. Before that, I think she was a waitress. She was an acrobat for a while. She did so many things. She was like a, what's it called when you're like the person that cleans the dishes in the restaurant or something, pot wash or something?
Oh, like the pot boy kind of thing, but not the boy, yeah, obviously, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. She had a lot of jobs before she was like 12. Yeah, she became an artist's model because she had an accident when she was an acrobat, so she could no longer be an acrobat. Yeah, she's in all these paintings that I have a list, actually, so I'm going to tell you some of them. There's one called Hangover, The Drinker, which is by Toulouse-Lautrec. I love this painting of her. She's like, she looks drunk. Mm. she looks really grumpy and drunk, and she's just in this kind of tavern. And yeah, it feels like a really kind of candid moment. But yeah, she's also in like a lot of Renoir paintings, like Dance at Bougival.
Yeah, she's in a lot of the very, like some really famous ones that people would recognize to see, right? Even if they don't remember the names.
Yeah, exactly. Degas as well painted her. And the really amazing thing about her was that she learned to paint by watching painters paint her, and started painting as well as modeling. I mean, her paintings are just, they're so, I love them so much. But just like her story as well, and how, I mean, being an artist model at that time, it was also expected that those models would sleep with the painters.
Yes, and they were kind of looked on as sort of no better than prostitutes, right, by sort of polite society.
Yeah, so she kind of like took the opportunity of being a model to learn how to paint, became a painter, later took her sketchbook and I think some paintings to Degas, who obviously she'd modeled for before. She was 22 when she took her drawings to Degas, who was the most successful artist at the time in Montmartre. After he looked at her sketches, he said, "You are one of us."
Because I presume there weren't a lot of women working in their circles at that point as well. You know, not like women were modelling for them, but they weren't necessarily being accepted as peers when it came to their talent and their, you know.
Yeah.
Wow. And do you remember how, I'd love to know how you first sort of came across her. Was there a particular portrait that captured your attention? Did somebody introduce you to her? Like, do you remember?
It was The Hangover.
Okay.
I think because she just looks so real in it. And there are all these other pictures of her, all these other paintings of her. She looks so perfect. And, you know, she's, I don't know whether she ever posed as a goddess or nymph or anything, but they're just very, I mean, a lot of them feel like she's posing as women who look like they're being watched without knowing that they're being watched, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's actually something I really love about her paintings. She paints herself a lot of the time and she's okay. Just looking directly at the viewer.
Wow.
It's quite intense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really, yeah, I love her work. But she also had a relationship, a really brief relationship with Eric Satie, the composer, who almost made it into Woman Eating, actually.
Really?
not as himself, but I was going to have at the Otter, the gallery where Lydia interns, I was going to have an exhibition about Eric Satie and Suzanne Valdon's relationship.
Oh, wow.
Because Satie himself is really strange. He only ate white food, which is really odd. He carried a hammer everywhere he went. It was very odd. The relationship is, it's really eccentric.
How fascinating. Has there been an exhibition where you sort of riffing off a real life exhibition? Or
I don't think so. There should be.
Yeah, it sounds like you should curate one. That sounds brilliant.
Yeah, they had such an interesting relationship. Like Satie gave her really weird gifts, like a necklace made out of sausages. And he once gave her, which I love and I'd love to do one day, empty paper bag that he said was full of the world's most wonderful smells.
Why? Like, he's got present giving down to her. Why not? Right?
But yeah, she left him, I think, quite suddenly, and he composed his piece, Vexations, which is like a really short piano piece, but you have to repeat it 840 times. People have performed it and got partway through and started like hallucinating and stuff and had to stop. So it's a really unusual piece of music. But I love that she had that effect on him. Yeah, but they drew each other, and actually her portrait of Satie is really interesting. He's kind of green-skinned. There's a lot of, like, green and pink, and it's kind of sickly. But yeah, Valadon, her work it's so beautiful. There's some sketches that she did, or I think they're, like, they must be pencil drawings or maybe etchings. They're quite, like, delicate line drawings of women, naked, bathing usually. And some of children as well being bathed. They look so recent, like they could almost have been done by Tracy Emin. They're just so, yeah, they're so candid, and it makes a difference that it's not by a male painter or a male artist, you know, looking at the woman who's bathing and then drawing her. It makes such a difference that she's kind of drawing herself and other women that she knew. But yeah, her work is I really love it. It's so bold and quite intense. Yeah, if you look at all of her self-portraits, you can kind of see her aging, and she's always just looking directly at the viewer, and it's very real, I guess, and she's amazing. But her son's work is known more than hers. I think that might be changing now.
Well, this is a good incentive for all our listeners to go and look at her. Look her up immediately, start looking at some of these portraits, and hopefully to gain a bit more attention. I knew the name, but I didn't know that much about her. So I'm fascinated now. You told me such wonderful stories. That's brilliant.
She's someone who was really known for being a mother, and that kind of dominated how she was received rather than her artwork actually kind of being the focus. Because, yeah, her son had quite a troubled life, so I think everyone just blamed her for it. So she became a part of his narrative. She's phenomenal.
Thank you so much, Claire. That was really fascinating. And thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing such brilliant recommendations and interesting stories with us. It was wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really lovely to talk.
Thank you all for listening. Our Shells is brought to you by the team at Virago Press, and special thanks to today's guest, Claire Coder, and turn in next time for more conversation about books, feminism and culture.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.